You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's show...
If he says great things about me, I'm going to say great things about him. I've already said he is really very much of a leader. I mean, the man has very strong control over a country. Now, it's a very different system, and I don't happen to like the system. But certainly in that system, he's been a leader far more than our president has been a leader.
Donald Trump has said that Russia's Vladimir Putin has been a better leader than Barack Obama. What will the American public think? And the UK's parliamentarians will move to a new home to accommodate a £4 billion renovation of Westminster. Is it a price worth paying? Also on the programme...
Turks were due to roll back their clocks an hour on October 30th and will instead remain an hour ahead even as the long winter nights draw in.
No turning back time in Turkey as the government opts out of daylight saving. We'll ask whether we should all do away with DST. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to the programme. My guests today are James Boyes, who's a political historian specialising in the United States and its place in the world. Also the author of Hillary Rising. We'll come on to that. We're also joined by Rosemary Hollis, Professor of International Politics at City University London. A warm welcome to you both. Let's start with Donald Trump's views on, respectively, Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama. Here's what he had to say.
If he says great things about me, I'm going to say great things about him. I've already said he is really very much of a leader. I mean, you can say, oh, isn't that a terrible thing he called? I mean, the man has very strong control over a country. Now, it's a very different system, and I don't happen to like the system. But certainly in that system, he's been a leader far more than our president has been a leader. We have a divided country. We have a country where you have Hillary Clinton with her emails that nobody's ever seen, where she deletes 33,000 emails. And that's after getting a subpoena from Congress. If you do that in private business, you get thrown in jail.
Donald Trump, the unmistakable sound. Perhaps I can start with you, James.
Sure.
What do you make of this constant return to the theme of Vladimir Putin and his imperious strength as a leader? Trump keeps going back there. I mean, it's very hard for anything that he says to take us by surprise, but are you surprised by this theme that he keeps returning to?
It's certainly difficult to take it seriously. There's no wonder they're talking about this as a bromance, quite frankly. It is quite astonishing. If you think about this, if you went back just a few years and heard a Republican candidate speaking so warmly about a Soviet leader, you know, it's just impossible. You know, the right used to, you know, win elections by eviscerating the Soviet leadership. Now we have Donald Trump talking in glowing terms about the leadership revealed by Vladimir Putin and talking about, well, he must be successful. He has over 80% approval ratings in Russia. Well, I don't think anybody takes those approval ratings seriously, except perhaps Donald Trump. It's one thing to hark back to a great man theory in history. It's another to try to reinvest that in the current era and talk about Vladimir Putin in such glowing terms. One can talk about Vladimir Putin's successful manipulation of events, I think, and his very, very adroit manipulation of potential weaknesses in the West. But to, I think, turn around in the United States and to suggest that the leader of Russia is more successful, is better, is stronger, faster, you know, you name it, than the American president is a remarkable turn of events, which I think very few people would have imagined being possible, certainly from a Republican candidate. And I'd suggest also, just finally, if a Democrat had said the same, you'd now see the right coming down on them like a ton of bricks and basically saying, see, you're a closet socialist.
I do think it's pushing against the tide to suggest that Putin is a leader to emulate and Russia's got a lot of things right. And I do wonder also, since Trump has also been telling us just how much he's going to expand the US military, but not use it, it would seem, just have it there so that the US is less likely to be pushed around. Well, I wonder if that's building up for a confrontation with the very Putin that he admires so much.
And it's interesting, isn't it, Rosemary, because variously at this campaign we've said, well, surely Trump's overstepped the mark. But then, bizarrely,
and slightly unpredictably, some of his most excessive pronouncements seem to still ring true with a demographic in the US. But on this point specifically,
James and I was talking about this before we came in the studio, and James was telling me something very interesting about somebody who was with the Trump campaign and resigned at the beginning of the summer. Do you want to repeat it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just this idea, isn't it, that recently a lot of people have picked upon what Michael Moore has suggested, saying that Donald Trump never wanted to get into this seriously. He just wanted to raise his profile. And that's been picked up on a lot because Michael Moore has said it. But at the back of the beginning of the summer, you know, one of Donald Trump's leading advisors quit and came out and said this quite openly back in, I think it was late May, early June. So the idea that there are serious questions asked about Donald Trump's seriousness about wanting to be president have been raised at the very, very highest levels. I'd also point out, actually, coming back to the issue about Putin, that it was only 4 years ago that it was the Republican Party nominee Mitt Romney who was basically rebuking Barack Obama for not taking Russia seriously. You might remember Obama mocked Mitt Romney for saying, well, you know, Governor, the 1980s want their foreign policy back. We're not in the Cold War anymore. Now we have the situation whereby, you know, we've got a Republican candidate who's saying that Vladimir Putin's the best thing since sliced bread, quite frankly. It's a remarkable, remarkable situation. And I think this is where Rosemary was going a little bit earlier on, in as much as, you know, if you look at Russia and Putin in his form of leadership, there is a very, very valid argument that one of the reasons he's been so bellicose overseas is because of the inherent weakness of his domestic program, his domestic support, and it's a smokescreen to hide his inherent weakness, not his strength.
And Rosemary, that's a good point. The historian Timothy Snyder put this rather elegantly, I thought. He said, Putin's the real world version of the person that Trump pretends to be on television. Does that calculation, or that lack of calculation from Trump, explain how we've seen exactly that extraordinary shift in terms of the rhetoric we're seeing from Republican presidential candidate?
Well, I don't see Trump as having ever taken his script from what the senior figures in the Republican Party would prefer. And I do see Putin as definitely, in light of what you just asked, exemplifying the sort of leadership that Trump fancies himself as being capable of. You know, the apprentice firing people, running a show that is very iconistic around one individual, and it's because of his great powers of imagination and insight into what makes a successful family, what makes us a successful country, and what makes a successful business. It's it all fits, but it doesn't fit with the US electoral machine as it's been hitherto, and it doesn't fit with the tenor of public opinion since the beginning of the Cold War.
And that's an interesting point, James, isn't it? Because it may well be very attractive on scripted reality, or whatever you call that particular genre of programs that Trump used to be on, but it shouldn't work, or we'd like to think it wouldn't work in the world's greatest democracy, and yet it still is working to a degree. If we sidestep a little bit away from the Putin bromance, as you described it, there's still this broader fact that Trump's rhetoric appeals to a very large number of people. How have we come to this? I'm sure it's a question I've basically asked you before, but in short, how did we get to this place?
Well, where do I begin with that? We've got another 3 hours to answer. one of the problems is that, you know, demagogues are very, very good at presenting seemingly simple solutions to very complex questions. And again, we were talking about this before we came on air. It's a simple philosophy, which is that if there were simple solutions to complex solutions, they would have been solved a long, long time ago. But the problem is, of course, you know, there's an awful lot of people who are following this election at a very sort of, you know, distant level. You know, they're not sitting there reading the New York Times and drilling down into this. They're taking it at a superficial level, but as most people do.
Would you not also say that there is genuine exasperation and boredom with a very comfortable intellectual elite, which has managed to monopolize a great deal of power in the political system, not only in America, but also in the UK? And this is a revolt against those cozy, comfortable people who thought they could run the show as a political elite, which doesn't pay attention to the grassroots.
You're absolutely right. There is a historical quote which I always get reminded about with regard to this, and it's from the 1950s. And just as Dwight Eisenhower was preparing to take over from Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, of course, had never had any election political experience beforehand. He'd always been in the army. And Harry Truman sat there just as he was about to leave office, and he said, I feel so sorry for Ike. He's going to come in here and he's going to sit at this desk and he's going to say, do this and do that, just as we might imagine Trump will be doing now. And Truman said, poor old Ike, he's going to be so disappointed. Nothing will happen. It's not like the army. And I think that's a very, very good example about the problems that Trump will find if he does get elected, which is that he will expect to be able to basically take that sort of a high-handed approach, which just doesn't work in politics. It has to be the art of persuasion, the art not of deal-making necessarily as Trump sees it, but of bringing together coalitions on a case-by-case basis. And he just has no propensity to do that.
Well, let's pick up on this theme of dysfunctional politics, why don't we? And also on this crisis of the political classes regime that you were talking about on both sides of the Atlantic, indeed. The UK's Houses of Parliament are getting a makeover. Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May has said all MPs will have to move out of their current home for a modest 6 years as the restoration project gets underway. The cost is £4 billion. Just leave a moment for that figure to sink in. What do you make of this, Rosemary? Is this the absolutely worst time in terms of people's confidence in the political class in this country to be shelling out that kind of money to do up the...
Yes, but they can't wait. They've put this off. They can't put it off any longer. The place is in a shambles, and it costs so much because everybody wants to keep this iconic Houses of Parliament that is sort of the branding of the UK. It would be very bad timing to say, well, we can't afford to refurbish it, so we'll tear it down and start again, and it would be much cheaper. That would save money. In that sense, I think there's a parallel with Trident. It's only symbolic. It's not useful.
Do you go along with that, James?
I think the only thing that's more expensive than doing the refurb would be building a new building or trying to find a new site for this. Let's be honest about it.
You think that would cost more?
Probably. By the time you've got a building of that size and let's look this way. You know what government projects are like? They'll say, oh, it would cost $2 billion to build, and then by the time the final bill comes in, it would cost $6, $7, $8
billion. Okay, yes, so, there's that. On the other hand, my understanding is that it makes it a much harder, much longer job to do, and therefore more expensive, to try and fix it within the edifice, which is itself crumbling.
I think we need to recognise the fact that just as the United States Congress building, the Capitol building in the United States, embodies, personifies, exemplifies democracy in that country, so the House of Commons, the Palace of Westminster, doesn't just signify politics in this country. You know, there's a reason we refer to it as the mother of all parliaments. It has historic significance. We can't just rip this building down.
There's only
down
one bit of it that goes back more than 100 years or so.
Fall into the Thames. I honestly think anybody would want this building not to be there.
Well, no, but I wonder. I don't want to be in sort of metaphorical overload, but there is this idea, okay, it's the cradle of modern parliamentary democracy or whatever you want to call it.
But it's not that particular Victorian building.
It's literally a rotting edifice. So isn't this? Wouldn't this actually provide Rosemary the perfect opportunity to say, well, look, away with all of this. Everyone's lost confidence anyway. Let's change, literally brick by brick, literally change the makeup
well,
of our
parliament.
Well,
now that would not fit with the kind of nostalgia that Theresa May, the new Prime Minister, is trying to exploit in the UK. Things like reviving grammar schools and so on. The time to have swept it away and started with a new model would have been Tony Blair in 1997 when he said, this is a young country and we don't do history.
James, how important do you think it is for, you know, we're talking about Trump in the US, we're talking about this potential refurbishment of Parliament. A lot of people would say, well, look, we're not talking about the substance. We're not talking about foreign policy and defence policy in the case of Trump. We're talking about, you know, their performance at this Commander-in-Chief forum. We're not talking about the business of government. We're talking about the buildings of Parliament. How important is it, though, to get these symbolic things right?
I think it is important, and I would completely agree, by the way, with Rosemary about the opportunity for reform that was completely missed, in my opinion, by Tony Blair back in 1997, and that goes for the House of Lords reform in particular. I think symbols are important. They are things which we can use to rally around. They are of questionable value in some people's minds. I can certainly see that. But I think that, you know, when we talk about politics, when we talk about history, when we talk about culture, it's important to have some things to cling on to, quite frankly. So much of London was destroyed in the war, for example, and was being rebuilt. And I think that what you're seeing across the capital now is a vibrant, dynamic, confidence city, which is managing to blend the new with the old in a really positive way. You know, I'm very, very proud to live in this city and to work here. And I think that when you can combine the historic buildings, and I completely take Rosemary's point about the fact that parts of that building are not as old as they appear, plus the fact, let's be honest about it, The House of Commons complex had a major makeover just a couple of decades ago when they put Portcullis House in across the street so that they could have
which
works perfectly. It's a great venue for offices, for members of parliament, and a great place to meet and engage with our members who represent us in the Commons.
Do you know, I'm just hypothesising what are the alternatives might include, and I'm thinking, you know, there's a very large garden just beside Buckingham Palace.
We're getting into some controversial territory now. Okay. I just wonder that when you walk around the world, it's interesting, James, you made the comparison with, say, the Capitol in Washington, D.C., of course, which I think, is that still under wraps as a refurb?
There was a refurb. I think it's basically, it was getting revamped, but it certainly wasn't getting rebuilt.
Okay, so it was having a bit of a tidy around the edges.
Yeah.
Do you look around the world at other parliamentary buildings on your travels and say, hey, do you know what, this actually provides a template for how, you know, Westminster should work? And do you see examples where, I don't know, if there's parliamentary buildings, for example, that actually make the business of doing government more efficient?
Let's be really honest about this. If we were going to say, right, we're going to start from scratch now, we would doubtless have a very, very different building. And we would have designers come in and we'd say, right, we need this, 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 and this. And it would be very different from what we have in place at the moment. But, you know, that would mean completely scrapping a lot of degree of British heritage and starting from scratch again. I think that if you look at what is there, it's a remarkable building. It's part of British heritage. And it's something I think we should be proud of. Let's keep it. Let's retain it. Let's recognise that the costs involved are astronomical. And quite frankly, it is embarrassing. But it's an all-party group that's come forward to suggest this. This isn't some sort of conservative plot being foisted by the nasty party upon the country. It is an attempt, I think, to reinvest in British culture, British society, and it will be something which, you know, again, this Rosemary rightly pointed out, it's cheaper than all the other options, I think, necessarily, that which are on the table. And that's certainly a point that the MPs have come forward and said, and it's something which has been put off for far too long.
And if nothing else, Rosemary, it's the Palace of Westminster has a reassuringly austere look about it. Would you know, go on that? I wish we could capture the face that you made when I said that.
I'm very struck by the fact that inside the Foreign Office building, there is a massive wall painting on the main staircase. And apparently that was there since the late 19th century in order to intimidate visitors from around the empire. This is all glorification of something that has long since gone.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. My guests are Rosemary Hollis and James Boyes. Coming up, is it time to get rid of daylight saving? But first, let's move to Turkey. Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has suggested he and the United States are ready to drive Islamic State militants out of the Syrian stronghold of Raqqa. Rosemary, come to you first of all on this one. How feasible is that plan? It seems like it's something that wouldn't even have been mentioned, not even a few months ago. Are we at a different place right now?
We are at a place where the fighters belonging to ISIS on the ground in Iraq and Syria are genuinely under pressure to the point that they are not only losing territory, but they're on the back foot. They're no longer on the advance. Now, a lot of specialists are warning that the consequences of pushing to the finish on the ground in Syria and Iraq, and Raqqa being the main objective that Turkey's talking about, to take out their main capital in Syria. The consequences of that could well be that all those who've spread out across the world, including across Europe, will become active instead of the bases in Iraq and Syria. So it's not the end of the ISIS problem. The other big question, insofar as with Turkey's involvement and troops on the ground, US blessing, and the Russians perfectly happy for this to happen too in Syria, that they capture Raqqa and they put ISIS fighters on the run and they rescue a lot of miserable citizens who've been under ISIS rule, and something similar happens in Iraq, in Mosul, the big question for the stability of both countries is, who do you put in place of the ISIS dispensation? And there's much less agreement between Turkey, Russia, the United States, and others.
And James, interesting, I guess, coming to you from maybe the US perspective here, the US is still intent on continuing its support that it's been offering so far, even though it's at odds in some respects with Turkey, for example, when it comes to, say, Kurdish fighters and other counter-ISIS groups. Some people in Turkey still suggest that the Turkish state supports IS in certain respects. How fractured a picture, and how difficult will it be, do you think, for whoever wins in November to make any real strides on this, given how turbulent the situation remains on the ground?
It's interesting the way you phrase your question, which is raising the all-important domestic situation which we see in the United States. First of all, let me say it's also being reported that the RAF are going to be involved in this, so the British will be involved alongside the Americans and the Turkish. I would suggest that we need to see this possibly through the prism of American domestic political situation, which is that there's a concept which is often referred to as the October surprise, the idea that if you were in power, you can manipulate events. How it would benefit Hillary Clinton, quite frankly, if the administration that she is basically purporting to try and to continue into a third term was to have a dynamic, impactful result in the weeks leading up to the presidential election. She'd be able to turn around and say, yes, this is the Obama-Clinton doctrine, effectively, which Donald Trump has been critiquing all this time. And we have now taken the battle to ISIS. There's been a lot going on that Donald Trump didn't know about. He didn't know more about this than the generals did, and his evidence of that. So it's important to note, I think, this idea of keeping an ace up your sleeve in American political life to play right before the election is something which we've seen on many occasions. It's not a new trick, and it's certainly something which, if this was to go through, could severely help Hillary Clinton, I think, in her claim to be continuing the Obama-Clinton doctrine into a third term.
But there's also a downside to that. Point taken, it makes good electoral politics. But the downside is that the Pentagon and the military men are considering the consequences of defeating ISIS and having to go into Raqqa, either through proxies or close involvement, street by street, and to whom do they hand it over? And this is the terrible story of Syria, from start to finish, that the heinous regime that is absolutely indiscriminate in the way that it kills civilians is constantly benefiting from the political maneuvers of the big players, both in the region and internationally. And what happens on the ground is not in the long term necessarily going to solve the kinds of problems that produced ISIS in the first place.
And Rosemary, on that point about the regime there, a lot of people are saying, well, look, you know, certainly in the, I was going to say short, but actually in the medium term, we need to reconcile the fact that there cannot be, you know, an adequate dealing with IS and a shift towards, you know, a regime change maybe in Syria that all of these proxy powers will agree on. So what happens? Do we have to continue this sort of slightly bizarre and loose alliance where we have Russia, Turkey, the US, maybe even the UK working at the edges to try and rein things back step by step to take Raqqa, and that we just have to acknowledge that we're not going to have a discussion about a change to the Assad regime for potentially years yet?
Well, no, I think they've tried to square that circle, actually. Certainly the British have tried to make their contribution with the conference here in London earlier this week, where they were considering the plan put forward by the Syrian opposition group that operates internationally and has alliances on the ground in Syria, even if they're not very close ones. And they are proposing a formula for the future of Syria, which is very appealing in Washington and in London and in other parts of Europe, and the Turks could ostensibly go along with. But it all depends on whether Russia is prepared to make Assad go along with this plan, which would see him step down within 6 months after negotiations and would see the full implementation of a ceasefire. This seems unlikely, but it therefore, why float it at all? It is to attempt to answer the Russian position, which says that if not Assad, then who? And they're saying, well, we have a blueprint for who? And I don't see this actually solving the problem. I think it's just another example of how there's a disconnect between what's happening on the ground in Syria and all the politics.
Let's stay in Turkey, but we'll have a bit of a change of pace, if not a change of time. Let's take a listen to our Istanbul Bureau Chief, Chris Lord. He has an update for us on a story we've covered from time to time here on Midori House.
Turkey is exercising its right to push radical new rulings through parliament under the state of emergency. This week, Prime Minister Bin Ali Yildirim decreed that Turkey will no longer be beholden to the oppressive rule of Greenwich Mean Time, and he has abolished the winter-summer time difference altogether. Turks were due to roll back their clocks an hour on October 30th, and will instead remain an hour ahead even as the long winter nights draw in. While the new decree will likely mean fewer missed dentist appointments, some Turks have bemoaned the change as making it harder to watch midnight European football matches. Turkey has a long history of fiddling with citizens' notion of time. After the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, clock towers were erected en masse to make the new republic's timekeeping chime with Europe. Now, perhaps presciently, the exact reverse is taking place.
Monocle's Istanbul Bureau Chief Chris Lord. Does Turkey have a point, James? Is this a sensible move to do away with daylight savings?
Yes, I don't claim to be an expert on this. My understanding is that this was something that was introduced very much to help the agricultural community, I think, at one point. Whether that's still necessary, I'm not really sure. It seems to me to be somewhat anachronistic, a little bit like an awful lot of speed limits on roads, and particularly in the United States, for example, was introduced. I know in the United States, the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit was only introduced because of fuel shortages, effectively, nothing to do with safety whatsoever. And yet that still remains a major factor now. So I think, we were talking a little bit earlier on about symbols and anachronistic situations and concepts which maybe could be done with getting away with in a modern 21st century setting. And, if we can contemplate possibly detonating the House of Commons, then maybe we could take a look at getting rid of daylight saving time altogether.
Rosemary, what do you make of this? Because if politics is supposed to be moving with the times, maybe moving the time, if you will, is rather sensible. It's another grand gesture that would show people politicians are maybe a rather more connected political class than perhaps a sceptical public thinks.
Well, yes, there's two ways of interpreting it. One is that you demonstrate your power by being able to dictate when it's 6 o'clock and when it's 5 o'clock. The other possibility is, though, that if they try it, because there's always winners and losers from whatever system you adopt, so long as it doesn't reverse the clock by 4 hours suddenly at the eastern end of Europe, inside Turkey, then there will be feedback from those who win and those who lose by the change, and there's nothing to stop Erdogan or whoever replaces him, if anybody ever does, changing their mind.
Indeed. Well, we'll have to keep a watching brief on this one. The clock is literally and metaphorically ticking, and we'll keep an eye. Rosemary Hollis and James Boyce, thank you both very much for your time this evening on Midori House. That is all we have time for today. The show was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Luke Saunders. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music on the way at 1900. Andrew Tuck, Monocle's editors here with The Urbanist. And we'll have more on the big stories of the day at 2200 London time, the Monocle Daily. Andrew Muller in the hot seat tonight. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.